Counsel, we're ready whenever you are.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathleen Hines. I am counsel for the Western World Insurance Company, bar number 30901. May it please the court, this case is a case that centers around an insurance company's duty to defend. Specifically, in this case, in 2003, a member of the Booth Creek Townhouse Association filed suit against the association, alleging that its property manager had failed to perform property management duties. This resulted in property damage. It resulted in a list of other damages because of their alleged omissions. The verified amended complaint, including the following allegations against the association: the defendants had failed to discharge their duties to the plaintiff and others by, among other things, failure to shovel snow, failure to repair, to maintain, and replace building materials, eave damage, repair exterior siding, correct stone veneer, correct unflash windows, so forth and so on, and effectively protect against mold and dry rot as requested by the plaintiff. The plaintiff in that case, Mr. Basick, alleged damages for cost of repair, failure to repair, loss of use, restoration, mitigation, loss of value, annoyance and inconvenience, and diminution of value. The underlying complaint was absolutely clear as to the types of damage alleged against the association and the actual cause of it, what conduct actually caused this particular damage. The association was insured by two different insurance companies. One was Western World. Western World, my client, provided a commercial general liability policy with $1 million in limits to the association. USLIC also insured the association. They issued a nonprofit professional liability policy. These policies covered different risks. Nonetheless, the complaint asserted in the underlying action triggered coverage under both policies. As set forth in the briefs that have been submitted, and as the court may know, the standard for a liability carrier's duty to defend its insured is very low. The Hecla Mining case, the Supreme Court case from 1991, is the essential case on this particular point. In that case, the court said an insurer has a duty to defend where a complaint against its insured alleges any facts that might fall within coverage of the policy, even if allegations only potentially or arguably fall within the policy's coverage. Further, the court said the appropriate course of action for an insurer who believes that it is under no obligation to defend is to provide a defense to the insured under a reservation of rights and seek reimbursement should the facts at trial prove that the incident resulting in liability was not covered by the policy, or to file a declaratory judgment after the underlying case has been adjudicated. If there is any doubt as to coverage, the insurer must defend the insured. This rule is axiomatic in insurance coverage law. It's been in effect for probably now going on 20 years.
Ms. Hines,
yes.
As to the duty to defend, do you dispute at all that Western World had a duty to defend on the claims in the Bassett complaint?
We do not. We actually had read the complaint in its broadest form, which is what our obligation under the Hecla Mining standard is, and determined that there was the potential for covered property damage. Now, this case has actually, the underlying case, you may or may not be aware, has gone up on appeal. The actual damage alleged was something like, or actually determined, was about $5,000. The case, however, generated in excess of $500,000 in defense costs. Hence our appeal. A $5,000 case on an indemnity question, we probably wouldn't be here, but my client has already paid in excess of $275,000 to defend this case on behalf of its insured. And of course, that has precipitated us seeking contribution from other liability carriers. Fundamentally, however, on the duty to defend, it is not the ultimate determination at trial that determines whether or not a carrier has a duty to defend. The determining factor is the four corners of the complaint compared against the policy. In this case, the USLIC policy covered the wrongful acts of its insured. It is not a policy that is coextensive with the coverage that was provided under the Western World policy. The Western World policy, being a commercial general liability policy, covered property damage and bodily injury that may, for which its insured may have become liable. It, very, very different types of coverage. At issue, and where what USLIC has defended its decision not to provide a defense to its insured, is the other insurance clause, first and foremost. USLIC has asserted that the other insurance clause basically creates a situation where its policy is excess to any other insurance policy that the insured may have had.
Well, do they really go that far?
Yes.
Well, don't they say that, I mean, as I understand it, the Western policy doesn't contain a similar provision that in its policy. Is that correct?
That is not correct. It does have a standard ISO other insurance clause, and I could read that to you if you'd be interested.
Does the other insurance clause in the Western policy say that, use the phrase at the end, unless such other insurance is specifically written to be in excess of the policy?
It does not say unless such other insurance is specifically written to be excess, but it does have something similar. And let me just pull that up for you. The Western World policy contains this provision, B, excess insurance. This insurance is excess over any of the other insurance, whether primary, excess, contingent, or on any other basis. That is, fire extended coverage, builder's risk, installation risk, or similar coverage for your work. And I would contend that if this dispute were to come down to competing excess insurance clauses, that clause was intended to create an excess status as to the USLIC policy.
Was that argued in the trial court?
I believe it was. I believe so. I'm not sure. But certainly, the primary issue here, however, is we don't even reach that point. Under the Cotter case and under other cases that have actually tried to resolve this issue, the policies for a competing excess other insurance clause argument to be made, the policies must cover the same risk. The Cotter case says that. That case is articulated in cases from other courts that have been cited in the briefing. The courts there address what the purpose of the other insurance clause is. The other insurance clause is intended to deal with policies that cover the same loss that are coextensive, not with policies that cover different risks. And conceptually, this goes to the fact that as insurance coverage analysts look at this, excess means beyond. It means above the primary layer of the same risk. And you can look at Couch on Insurance, and you can look at other scholars who have explored this. Excess means coextensive and for the same risk. It does not apply to policies that cover different risks.
Does Cotter actually hold that?
Cotter specifically says if it covers the same risk. That's included in one of the statements it makes. It's not as clear as I would have liked it to be, but it does reference covering the same risk in the content of that opinion, yes.
Did Cotter deal with two excess policies?
No, it dealt with, I believe, competing other insurance clauses. And I might be mistaken on that, but I believe it was two primary policies. And again, the distinction is here we have two primary policies. We're not talking about a true, genuine excess or umbrella policy, which is a policy that explicitly says it does not kick in until the underlying policy or underlying insurance has been, the policy limits have been reached. These are two primary policies. Were it not for the Western world policy, USLIC does not dispute that it would have had an obligation to defend its insured, and that's the distinction here.
All right, but in the USLIC policy, they have another insurance clause, and the language of that clause said that they shall be in excess of and not contribute with other existing insurance, including but not limited to any insurance under which there is a duty to defend.
Right.
What is your position on what that means?
That, again, they have a very vague other insurance clause. Most standard ISO policies have a fairly explicit other insurance clause, which is exactly what I recited to you out of the Western World policy. In my opinion, not only does, again, if we're talking about competing excess clauses, I believe that language creates an ambiguity at best. Honestly, I don't think we actually have to reach that because of the nature of the difference in coverage here. We're not talking two liability policies with a dispute as to which one comes in first. We're talking completely different levels of coverage. And that I think, first and foremost, has to be addressed. But as to your question again, I think, if anything, that clause creates an ambiguity in the policy. And that is where the analysis for conflicting other insurance policies actually ends up. The courts that address those go to the issue of whether or not there is an ambiguity. And of course, as you know, it's axiomatic that if there is an ambiguity in the policy, it is construed in favor of the insured. And the principle, the public policy behind that is to make sure that the insured is protected and to avoid the nightmare the courts face with these types of competing clauses.
Explain to me again, please, what you deem to be the ambiguity in that clause?
It's
the USLIC clause.
There are several, actually. First of all, what does it mean by excess? Excess is not defined in that particular clause. That is, again, if you're going to read it as on its face and as a fundamental insurance precept, excess means beyond the primary layer. It has nothing to do with two completely different policies. And so, number one, I think there's a question there. What do they mean by excess? Other insurance, I think the secondary problem here is, if you read that on its face, that could mean any type of insurance whatsoever. If I had an automobile policy that somehow kicked in here and applied, then that would mean that they were excess and they could step out and not defend their insured. That, I think, defeats the reasonable expectations of the insured and renders their policy essentially meaningless on that point. I think it's ambiguous, I think it's overbroad, and I think it needs to be read in the context of how insurance policies are typically interpreted and what excess actually means to those that are in the insurance industry.
Okay, what would you say that the meaning of when it includes language of under which there was a duty to defend, when mm-hmm. it refers to other existing insurance, mm-hmm. what is meant by that?
What is meant by if they have a duty to defend?
Right, I'll just read that again.
Okay.
Other existing insurance, including but not limited to any insurance under which there is a duty to defend.
I honestly don't understand that. Again, it doesn't make sense to me why they would focus on whether or not there was a defense. Again, any other insurance clause, including Western World's own insurance clause, would address both defense and indemnity obligations. So I can't speak to why they would have picked that out as something that they wanted to focus on. To me, again, that doesn't excuse them for failing to defend their insured under their policy, which explicitly covered a defense obligation for any wrongful act alleged against their insured. Okay, the second defense that a USLIC has asserted has to do with Exclusion A. Again, this goes to the reasonable expectations of its insured. If you read that exclusion on its face, it would basically eviscerate the policy. It would basically remove any potential for coverage of a property management company, which is what the association was. The association was charged with the responsibility to maintain that property. I would contend that it's overbroad, but I would also contend that the policy, the way it's written, has an ambiguity between the mold exclusion and between exclusion A. The mold exclusion includes, it specifically mentions diminution in value. Exclusion A does not. And I would propose that that creates the potential that there would be coverage for diminution in value, which was specifically alleged in the underlying complaint.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court. Catherine Tallarico, 19995, on behalf of USLIC. I would like to start in speaking about exclusion A. It is not ambiguous. It provides the policy, USLIC's policy provides coverage for the association's wrongful acts in its performance of its professional duties, but it excludes a defense and coverage for damages, for any damages arising, or for any claims arising out of damage to or destruction of tangible property. The exclusion means simply that the claims against the association for errors and omissions that may have caused damage to or destruction of property are excluded from the coverage. And what's the reason for this exclusion? Because the CGL policy provides coverage for tangible property damage. So it is a dovetail. It is not unusual. Some of the cases that are cited in the briefing of the parties cite to some overviews, which demonstrate that most, if not all, D&O policies have exclusions for tangible property damage and bodily injury, because those are the two things that are covered under a CGL. The cases that, if you look at our exclusion, it is the company shall not be liable for the loss or defense costs in connection with any claim, and then it has uses the terms arising out of, directly or indirectly resulting from, in consequence, or in any way involving. So it's big and broad. And the Colorado cases, and that's tangible property damage. The Colorado cases that I've cited in my brief and then supplemented all indicate that the term arising out of means growing from, originating from, creates a but-for test. And in this case, you have the exclusion actually going to the genesis, the origin, the underlying harm. That is the tangible property damage. And then if you look at all the claims for relief, there are various multi-different kinds of duties and obligations that the association allegedly breached. But each of them flow out of the damage to the property, the physical property damage. There cannot be a dispute that, like in management specialists, the Colorado Court of Appeals case, the only reason this claim was brought, the whole lawsuit was brought by Mr. Bassick, is because of his property damage that he sustained from because of the lack of maintenance. Every single claim for relief within the complaint and the amended complaint states in it, and this includes the breach of contract, the fiduciary duty, and discusses specifically the damage to the property that was caused by these multiple reasons, but the causation isn't important. It's the end result, which is the tangible property damage. And this is the analysis that the Colorado courts have adopted. The Supreme Court in the Gonzalez case has said, you look at the underlying harm. The underlying harm, those are the use of motor vehicle kinds of cases. But the underlying harm is the injury caused by a motor vehicle. And the things that, how it gets there, for instance, is it Denver's failure to put a pothole, or failure to fix a pothole? Is it Denver's methodology in not putting up enough signs around the pothole? In the other case that was discussed in Gonzalez, and I can't recall the name of the plaintiff, but it related to a failure for brakes. And again, Gonzalez case looked at both the cases together. I think it was Brock. In that case, the claim was against a person that was supposed to fix the brakes on a truck. That and the court said, yeah, So brakes on a truck, fixing the brakes, negligent maintenance, negligent failing of fixing a pothole, failure to warn, all of them come out of, they originate from that injury that is not, that is excluded. And that's what this policy does.
Ms. Tallarico, I understand Western World's position on this is that is so broad that what would be covered under the insurance? So what type of claims would the USLIC policy cover?
Thank you for asking that. The illusory argument is made by Western World, was made in the underlying lawsuit. We have attached the in the record. You'll see the bylaws and the declarations. You will see the state statute under Kiowa, the duties and obligations of a homeowners association, which is not a property management company. It is a statutory created nonprofit organization under Kiowa. That's what this is. It's an HOA. It's a nonprofit. It's not a property management company. But if you look at the bylaws and you look at the declarations, a lot of it, most of it, is financial. It adopts bylaws, budgets. It projects expenditures. It calls for assessments. It sues over underpayments of assessments. It hires and fires employees. Those sorts of things are covered by the wrongful termination part of the USLIC policy, and then the theft and stuff would be covered under the USLIC policy, embezzlement, things of that nature.
In that regard, let me ask you this then. If there was other existing insurance which had a duty to defend for those types of claims, would USLIC come in after that defense?
Well, USLIC originally said that it did not have the Western World insurance policy and didn't know what its other insurance policy said. The provision, the other insurance provision, and it denied based on this exclusion A. And then we learned that there was a their other insurance provision provided for pro rata sharing. Our other insurance provision provided for excess. So, in this case, there is no coverage. There is absolutely no coverage under our policy because of the wrongful acts. All relate to, arise from, grow out of that tangible property damage. Now, if something happened to have been covered, then what would have happened is that excess provision would kick in, the other provision, and we would then be excess over. So if they hit $1,000,001, we would step in, $1,000,001.
Is that still a possibility here?
I understand that the case is up on cert on the attorney fee issue, but everything else is resolved. Nothing else has been appealed. So I don't know where the attorney fee issue will go. The attorney court of appeals has determined that the attorney's fees were unreasonably awarded with the $5,000 judgment and the $400,000 in attorney's fees.
And Ms. Tallarico, what is your position on Western World's statement that only if the two insurances cover the same risk or same loss?
Okay. May I just finish with one other comment on the illusory piece? I also provided the affidavit of the claim specialist, Matthew Rubin, who is a USLIC, in all the underlying briefing, and that was not disputed. And that affidavit demonstrates all the myriad of claims that an association is covered by under the USLIC policy. And it's just a lot of stuff, and it, as long as it doesn't relate to tangible property damage, it would be covered. Going to the other insurance provision, the same risk. The Cotter case actually addresses a primary and an excess policy, and I'm not quite sure why the Cotter calls it a different risk. I don't think they're really looking at that issue, but what they said is primary goes up to $1,000,000 and excess comes after that, therefore it's different risks. That's what Cotter says. But if you look at all the cases, such as the Farmington versus United Education case, which comes out of both the District Court of Colorado and then it's been affirmed at the Tenth Circuit. In that case, Farmington issued a CGL to the University of Colorado, and United Educators issued a sort of like a D&O. It's an educator's D&O policy. the CGL, a person was fired, and the person brought lots of claims. Included in the claims were defamation. CGL picked up on that. The United Educators Fund had all the other stuff, the wrongful termination, sexual harassment, discrimination, due process civil rights type of claims. So it's different risks, just like here. And in that case, the district court looked at the issues and said the excess provision, which was in the DNO policy that United Educators prevailed over the CGL's primary policy or pro rata policy. And the reason was, just like here, the pro rata policy in Western World, which I have here, talks about that it is primary, their duty to defend. So right after primary insurance, under other insurance, it says we are primary, except unless there's somebody else that's excess, and then it gives a bunch of exclusions about who would be access to them. And none of those issues, by the way, were raised by Western World in the trial court. The complaint, the briefing, all indicate that they want to share with us. They didn't think we were access. I mean, they didn't think they were access to us. The other insurance of Western World also says, if other valid and collectible insurance, which is one of the key provisions in the Fireman's Fund case, the Farmington case, and the insurance of Company of North America case, all say that if that language is in there, an excess provision, other insurance with the excess clause can't possibly be co-primary. It will always, it's not valid and collectible. Our insurance is not valid and collectible because it has the other insurance. The other case, just to address your issue, Your Honor, the plaintiff cited to a New York case, and New York is in a complete state of flux right now on whether or not the same risk has to be covered. So Colorado says no, it doesn't have to be the same risk. In Fireman's Fund in New York, a CGL policy and a DO policy, it's issued in about 1996, that case. And they say the excess that's in the directors and officers policy, just like ours, prevails, and the CGL has to pay for everything. That's Fireman's Fund. Then at the beginning of this year in Fieldstone, a division of the New York court, lower court, held that no, we're disregarding that case. And then in Sport Rock, which just came out 4 months ago or so, 3 months ago, declined to follow that. So other jurisdictions are looking at this issue, but in Colorado, the case that is most prominent is Farmington.
Well, let me ask about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Western says, as I understand it, Cotter decides this case. You say, nope, not so fast. Cotter doesn't really say that. It's a different situation.
Right.
And then we have the Farmington case, and then we have cases around the country. Is there any, in your view, is there any published appellate decision from Colorado State Court, either a division of our court or Colorado Supreme Court, that addresses this issue?
The risk issue?
Yes.
No, I don't think there is. I think we'd have to look at Farmington. Boy, I had a lot of other things. Any other questions?
Let me ask you about the other insurance clause in the USLIC policy. What does it mean when it says it is excess to other existing insurance, including the duty to defend? What does that mean?
Okay, the other existing insurance is broadly defined as other existing insurance that, then it says right after it that has, including that which has the duty to defend. So it's, I believe, reading it, it is a nice, big, broad exclusion that is contractually obligated to follow. I don't think it's ambiguous. The existing insurance, if you look up existing in Black's Law, it's something enforced, so it's not like, you know, some other strange insurance that they might have or might not have. And in this case, it's always hard to speculate about what the other insurance provision would mean, because really you have to look at the two policies and compare them together and also look at what the complaint says. But in this case, it is clear Western World had a duty to defend and was other existing insurance. So no matter how you read it, in this case, it is absolutely clear that Western World falls within that portion of the agreement. And if Booth Creek didn't want to have either of those two provisions in there, it could have shopped the D&O. It's D&O insurance. It is not a difficult thing to procure. The other point I'd like to make is Western World absolutely cannot, under Colorado statutes, under Kiowa, say that it is excess to USLIC. It is obligated to provide insurance under Kiowa that provides for liability for maintenance and ownership of the common areas, which is what Mr. Bassick's complaint is all about. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course. That completes our oral argument docket for the afternoon, and the bailiff may announce a recess.
All rise. The court will be in recess. Subject.